final case on the morning calendar, appeal number 09-1742, Overstreet versus Astru. And the, we have Mr. Schultz in the enviable position of being the 17th lawyer to stand up here this morning. Mr. Sanchez, you'll be the 18th. But, it's always a tough position to be in, to be the last to talk. Mr. Schultz.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Catherine Overstreet. The first issue I wanted to discuss was the ALJ's violation of Social Security Ruling 00-4P. In the Prochaska versus Barnhart case, this Court interpreted 004P to indicate that an ALJ has the affirmative responsibility to ask a vocational expert whether or not his testimony is consistent with or conflicts with information in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. If the ALJ fails to ask that question, even if the plaintiff or the claimant was represented by counsel, the case should be reversed and remanded unless it's, of course, it's subject to the harmless error analysis. But other than the harmless error, the ALJ's violation of the ruling requires reversal. In this case, the ALJ failed to ask the vocational expert whether or not his testimony was consistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. And there is a potential inconsistency in the file in that all the jobs mentioned by the vocational expert are sedentary jobs. And by definition, sedentary jobs are those requiring sitting most of the day with occasional standing and walking as the job requires. But the administrative law judge's findings and in the hypothetical question included a limitation to that the claimant needed to alternate sitting and standing every hour. So that's a potential inconsistency with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which defines sedentary jobs as stated as sitting jobs. I'd like to point out that there's a distinction that this Court has made between cases where the ALJ has asked the vocational expert whether or not there's a conflict and those where the ALJ has not asked the question. In the Overman case, the administrative law judge asked the vocational expert whether there was a conflict, and the VE, the expert, said there was no conflict. In that case, this Court held that even there, if there's an obvious or apparent conflict on the record, the case should be reversed. But where the ALJ has not asked the question, there does not need to be an obvious or apparent conflict, only a potential unresolved conflict, because otherwise the ruling, the aspect of the ruling that puts the affirmative responsibility on the ALJ to ask the question, would have no meaning.
In this case, didn't counsel at the hearing ask some questions of the VE about whether the testimony was consistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles?
I don't believe he did. Now, he asked some questions of the VE, but he did not ask if it was if the testimony was consistent with the DOT. At least not my recollection of the record, Your Honor. The next issue I wanted to address was the ALJ's failure to consider the opinions of the state agency psychologists. As Ms. Goldblum stated in the last case, Social Security Ruling 96-6P states that the ALJ has to consider the opinions of all state agency psychologists and physicians and has to, in the decision, include the rationale for the weight given those opinions. In this case, although the state agency psychologist opinions were issued 3 years prior to the date that Ms. Overstreet claimed she became disabled, they're the only opinions by mental health experts in this record. So the administrative law judge found that one of Ms. Overstreet's impairments was a history of depression, and he noted that she testified to depression and that one of her doctors noted depression. And then he found that she only had a mild limitation in concentration, persistence, and pace. The state agency psychologists opined that the claimant was either markedly limited in concentration, persistence, and pace, one of the doctors, or moderately limited, one of the other doctors. Despite that significant discrepancy between the ALJ's findings and the psychologist's opinions, the ALJ made no reference to those opinions in his decision.
Ordinarily, it looks like a pretty serious problem. I haven't seen a case before though, where in the interim you had an intervening decision by an ALJ on an earlier application that took into account those opinions and said she's not disabled.
Yeah, that is a factual distinction in this case. But the other evidence that was submitted, the evidence of the continuing problems with the claimant's back and her more significant problems with her neck and that she was having flare-ups with her ulcerative colitis, that evidence is new. And the ALJ had to consider the combination of all of the evidence. The prior ALJ in this case wouldn't have had the same combination of evidence for Ms. Overstreet. So the plaintiff's not alleging that she's disabled by her mental impairments alone.
There was no, after that 2002 denial, was there any further history of treatment of depression?
There was no treatment for the depression, no. I think one of the key factors, though, is that the ALJ in this case found that Ms. Overstreet suffered from depression. You know, perhaps, based on the evidence, he could have analyzed it and said that he didn't see any basis for a diagnosis of depression. But having found that she was depressed, he had to have some basis in the record to determine what level of severity in her concentration, persistence, and pace was established. There's really literally no analysis by the ALJ. He makes the finding that she was mildly limited without any analysis at all on the record, and we believe that requires reversal. In addition, Ms. Overstreet suffers from four separate physical conditions, maybe five, degenerative disc disease of the cervical spine and of the lumbar spine, fibromyalgia, active ulcerative colitis, an assessment of chronic headaches, along with depression, all conditions which either can cause pain, the first four or five, and depression, which can exacerbate a person's experience of pain. The ALJ's decision in this case does not consider the combination of Ms. Overstreet's impairments in analyzing her pain and the severity of her pain. There's no discussion of the aggravating and precipitating factors of her pain. He doesn't really discuss the nature and onset and frequency of her pain, and those are things that he's required to do by regulation and by ruling. And when an individual suffers from multiple impairments, all of which can cause a symptom, the ALJ has to consider those impairments in the aggregate. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sanchez.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, Alfred Sanchez, appearing on behalf of Michael J. Estrue, the Commissioner of Social Security. Your Honors, a couple of things. Of critical importance to this case is the fact that Ms. Overstreet bore the burden of proving that she was unable to perform her past sedentary work. Although the record establishes that she has some limitations, those limitations do not prevent her from performing her past sedentary work, thus she has failed to carry that burden. Another critical factor in this case is the time period under consideration, which is rather short. Ms. Overstreet filed a prior disability application, which was denied by an ALJ's decision on May 20, 2002. Thus, the period through that date has already been adjudicated by the Commissioner and is a final decision. She did not appeal that decision. Further, Ms. Overstreet, in her current application, amended her alleged onset date to July 24, 2003 because she had been performing substantial gainful activity until that time. Additionally, Ms. Overstreet performed substantial gainful activity throughout 2005, a finding Ms. Overstreet did not challenge below. Thus, the time period we're looking at is from July 25, 2003 to December 2004. The record in this case does not show that Ms. Overstreet's limitations were more significant during the portions of the period under consideration when she was working than when she was not working than when she was. And the court should consider the reasonableness of the ALJ's decision within that context. Ms. Overstreet makes much of the fact that the ALJ in this case did not ask the vocational expert if his testimony was consistent with the DOT. However, that the ALJ did not make that inquiry does not in and of itself necessitate remand because the VE's testimony in this case was consistent with the DOT. Contrary to Ms. Overstreet's assertion in her reply brief, this court concluded in Kettlebolter versus Astru that not asking the question to the VE does not necessitate remand when the DOT's descriptions of the jobs discussed by the VE are consistent with the limitations given by the ALJ in its hypothetical question to the VE. As this Court has acknowledged, the Dictionary of Occupational Titles does not address sit-stand options. Similarly, the DOT does not address the need to have access to a restroom. Indeed, Ms. Overstreet acknowledged that the DOT does not address whether jobs allow for a sit-stand option, and in her district court brief, as the district court observed, Ms. Overstreet conceded that the DOT's descriptions of the data entry clerk and administrative assistant jobs say nothing about those jobs allowing for a sit-stand option or requiring access to a restroom. In this case, as was the case in Kettlevolter, the DOT's descriptions of the jobs identified by the VE do not conflict with the hypothetical limitations given by the ALJ. Therefore, this case is not like Prochaska, where the jobs identified by the VE as defined by the DOT required specific physical capabilities beyond the claimant's limitations. Here, the VE testified that two of Ms. Overstreet's past jobs, out of several she had held, would accommodate the limitations set forth in the ALJ's hypothetical question. The VE's testimony in no way conflicts with the DOT. While the ALJ did not do everything he was supposed to do, it did not affect the outcome of this case because there are no conflicts, apparent or otherwise, between the VE's testimony and the DOT. Thus, this Court can be assured that the error was not harmful, unlike Prochaska, where the Court could not determine whether the VE's testimony was consistent with the DOT.
Mr. Sanchez, before you go on, can I just make sure I understand? Are you talking about the VE's testimony about her prior work or about other jobs that she would be able
about
to do?
About her prior work.
Okay. Does that make a difference in terms of this harmless error analysis, whether it's looking at jobs that we know the plaintiff was able to perform before?
I don't think it does. It may make it a little easier, but I think if the VE's testimony is if the descriptions of the jobs identified by the VE are consistent with the limitations given by the ALJ, and there are no conflicts, I think this Court can be assured that the outcome of the ALJ's decision wasn't affected by his her failure to ask that question. Ms. Overstreet argues that the ALJ arbitrarily found the need to sit and stand at one-hour intervals. She never raised this issue in district court, and her confusion as to what the ALJ meant by sit stand with regard to 1 hour interval, I think, is a little confused. The ALJ presented the VE with a hypothetical question, and the VE understood that question to mean, those limitations to mean, that after sitting or standing for an hour, Ms. Overstreet could take a short break and return. It wasn't that she needed to alternate between sitting and standing 1 hour each, is that she could take a short break. And I think that the VE understood that question to mean that she could take a short break, and the VE stated, and I think that if she were able to take a short break after an hour, that she'd be able to do the sedentary work. Ms. Overstreet claimed or testified that she could only sit or stand for 2 minutes at a time, and the ALJ observed that she actually sat for about an hour at her administrative hearing. Moreover, no medical source opinion offered more generous limitations, and Ms. Overstreet's work activity was not consistent with her claim that she can only sit for 2 minutes. Ms. Overstreet reported working at an airport. Actually, in 2005, she was working as a customer care representative. She had worked there since May of 2004, and this job involved sitting in a golf cart, driving people to their gate, as well as pushing some individuals in wheelchairs. So in this case, the ALJ appropriately accommodated any need for her to sit or stand, and he gave her that one-hour option, and that, again, that limitation was consistent with the was not inconsistent with the dictionary occupational titles. One other thing, with respect to Ms. Overstreet's concern about her mental functioning, her argument is premised entirely on state agency review and psychologist opinions, which were generated in 2000 in connection with her prior disability application. I think it's important to understand why those opinions were included in the file with the current application. In putting together the file for the current application, the ALJ included the file from Ms. Overstreet's prior application, which happened to include these state agency psychologist opinions, I think, because her initial alleged onset date was May 2000. Now, she amended her alleged onset date to July 24, 2003, because she had been working. Notably, both state agency psychologists concluded that Ms. Overstreet was capable of performing substantial gainful activity. And consistent with those opinions, an ALJ found in a decision dated May 20, 2002, that Ms. Overstreet was not disabled. Ms. Overstreet did not appeal that decision. In evaluating Ms. Overstreet's current application, the ALJ acknowledged her history of depression and, in fact, assessed her mental limitations under the special technique prescribed by the Commissioner's regulations and articulated that finding in his decision. Thus, he explicitly considered it. Again, these state agency opinions were generated almost 3 years before Ms. Overstreet alleges she became disabled. Moreover, Ms. Overstreet worked subsequent to these decisions until July 2003, in fact, and there's quite a gap in time between these opinions when they were offered and when she alleges she became disabled. Notably, when Ms. Overstreet filed her current application for disability, she alleged disability solely on the basis of physical limitations. The ALJ reviewed the entire record, but quite appropriately focused his discussion on that evidence that was time relevant to the current application. If the state agency of physician opinions didn't establish disability at the time they were rendered, they cannot remotely establish disability now, particularly when Ms. Overstreet was working in succeeding years. The issue before the ALJ was what was Ms. Overstreet's functioning between July 2003 and December 2004. And Ms. Overstreet does not allege that she was under a disability prior to 2003. And as the district court observed, throughout the 888-page transcript, there's no evidence that Ms. Overstreet had mental limitations or received any mental health treatment during the period she alleges. Indeed, in her entire argument, Ms. Overstreet does not cite any medical evidence other than the opinions offered in connection with her prior application. Ms. Overstreet's treating physicians did not refer her to any mental health specialist for treatment, and the absence of such a referral suggests that they did not find her to have significant mental limitations. Rather, the evidence during the relevant period under consideration shows that Dr. Kacha, plaintiff's treating physician, noted that Ms. Overstreet was within normal limits psychiatrically. Additionally, in July 2003, Dr. Masick noted Ms. Overstreet's complaints of stress related to her upcoming wedding, but did not suggest that she had mental limitations. Thus, the ALJ reasonably found that Ms. Overstreet did not have significant mental limitations during the relevant period at issue. Again, this, with respect to Ms. The credibility finding, the ALJ considered her impairments in combination. He did not look at and do a specific pain analysis for headaches or pain analysis for back pain. He looked at he did a general credibility finding for pain, and it was based on entire medical evidence and listening to her testimony at the hearing. He considered her activities, which in this case is admittedly a little unusual in that most claimants are working 4 hours a day, 6 to 12 hours at a time, pushing people in wheelchairs at the airport. But the ALJ did consider that. He also considered her treatment, use of medications, and then found that she was that no further limitations were necessary. Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Hamilton, in response to your question, the attorney did ask the vocational expert as to whether there is a concerning the DOT, but that was only concerning the surveillance system monitor job, considering the plaintiff's past relevant work as data entry. And, in fact, the VE's testimony was that there was a conflict between the DOT because the DOT says the surveillance system monitor job is a governmental job. Vocational expert, however, testified about other types of monitor jobs, like in a parking lot, but didn't explain why, how he came to his conclusions in that point.
Thank you.
I believe that Mr. Sanchez is incorrect, and the district court was incorrect in finding that this is a short period of time. The fact that Ms. Overstreet worked during 2005 at the substantial gainful activity level would not preclude her being able to receive benefits during part of that time as well as afterwards if she's found disabled from her alleged onset date in July of 2003 and thereafter. It's a rather complicated or complex analysis, but there's something called the trial work period where a person is allowed to work after being found disabled and still collect benefits, and then there's an extended period of eligibility during which they might be eligible for benefits. So we're not just looking at this year-and-a-half period, but potentially the entire period of time up through the present for Ms. Overstreet. I just wanted to add one more thing. Factually, I think Prochaska is actually extremely similar to this claim. In Prochaska, the administrative law judge found that the claimant could only occasionally reach overhead, and the Dictionary of Occupational Titles included for the job at question the need to be able to frequently reach. But it didn't say specifically reaching overhead. And the Prochaska court held that's a potential conflict that needed to be cleared up by the vocational expert. So the fact that the Dictionary of Occupational Titles doesn't say that a sedentary job could be done if the person needs a sit-stand option is also a potential conflict. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel. This case is taken under advisement, and the court will now.